You're now listening to the first Liminalist Podcast Between, coming to you, not live, from Galicia, Spain.
Would I get free? You've gotta buy. I'm proud of my life, but don't ask me why. 'Cause if I told you,
I've been organically inspired by some audios that I was listening to via the recommendation of Mike B, readings from transcripts of old lectures by Rudolf Steiner from the early 1900s, specifically one on the dead. The disclaimer here is that anthroposophy, which is an impossible word, very unwieldy, was Steiner's own, his cover version of Theosophy. By Steiner's own testimony, he refused to take anything that he found in Theosophy on faith, and only incorporated those ideas and concepts or descriptions that he could himself personally validate, experience directly. How he did so is not yet known to me, although I'm sure he talks about it somewhere. I've been listening to these audios while falling asleep at night, and my MP3 player just keeps on playing them while I'm asleep, and so they've been bleeding into my dreams, and then little snippets here and there have been getting through my conscious mind. And in this case, they were intriguing enough for me to want to go back to them and listen to them more consciously. And then, as I've done, cull what I think of as the highlights. And I suppose my main, or one of my criteria, is how well does this material intersect with the things that I've been exploring with Dave Oshana and getting into closer contact with in my own life. And so specifically in the realm of the dead, which of course is the realm of the ancestors or corresponds with that realm also, and the relationship between that other dimensional realm of existence and the sensations within the body, that seems very central to my current trajectory and interest. By no means am I willing or able to take on the whole Steiner Weltanschauung. I think that there's an awful lot of it that is unverifiable, and the means by which he came upon this knowledge has to be questioned. It was either inside information of secret societies, channeled / psychically accessed knowledge, or stuff he made up. Possibly a combination of all three. The fourth possibility is that Steiner was enlightened, or at least close enough to a much deeper state of receptivity and responsibility to be able to ascertain these things directly through experience, experientially. I'm being selective anyway with what I'm going to share, and particularly looking for, or at least responding to, areas that converge closely with things that I've been discovering via my collaboration with Dave Oshana. And so I'm going to start with something there that Steiner says specifically about language, which directly echoes things that Dave Oshana said. This is from Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, 15 lectures from 1919. These are all read by Dale Brunsfeld and can be found at the rudolfsteineraudio.com site as linked in the show notes.
In other words, our languages are obstacles to understanding the social realm. and humanity will only develop insight into society by emancipating itself from merely linguistic understanding. But nowadays people abhor everything that goes beyond mere linguistic comprehension. And what one most often finds is that when anyone tries to explain something to you, they first offer you some verbal explanation. And yet it does not matter at all how you call or name something, what words you use to describe it. What is important instead is to lead people to reality, not to words. Above all, therefore, if we wish to develop social understanding, we must overcome our entanglement in language. And this can happen only if we also overcome the greatest prejudices of our time.
From The Influence of the Dead on Destiny, lectures from December 1917.
Now, for someone who is able to see these things in their proper light, the matter appears as follows. If you see a horse-drawn vehicle, a cab with a horse in front, the horse is drawing the cab. You will, of course, say that the driver is sitting on the box and guiding the horse with the reins. But if you ignore the driver, you will find it interesting to study what goes on in the horse to make it draw the cab. You can go into every detail of how the horse sets about drawing the cab, if you leave aside the fact that it is given its intention by the cab driver. This is the actual basis of Darwinian theories. One simply leaves aside the driver, saying it is an old superstition, a prejudice to say that the driver is guiding the horse. The horse is drawing the cab, anyone can see that, for the horse is in front. Darwinian theory is entirely based on this kind of logic. Being thus biased, it has, of course, brought to light some excellent truths, which are of the first magnitude. But it blocks all possibility of a real overview. Countless scientific facts suffer at the empirical level from the fact that people overlook the driver. They speak of cause and effect, but they seek the cause for the movement of the cab in the horse, considering this to be a great advance. People fail to realize that this type of confusion between horse and driver, such horse theories, if you will, forgive my putting it bluntly, exists right, left, and center in modern science. These theories cannot be proved wrong, just as it is not wrong to say the horse draws the cab. This is quite correct, but true and false in the outer sense is not the issue. Materialistic thinkers will always be able to refute a spiritualistic thinker who knows that the driver is there as well. Here you see where the hair-splitting, astute, critical intellect could lead, which the spirits of darkness want human beings to have. It does not matter about getting things right, let alone complete. What counts is that one follows the model where the horse draws the cab. Logic can easily separate from reality and go its own way. It is possible to be utterly logical and at the same time be far from reality. Something else has to be considered when we speak of human evolution. It is that the spirits of darkness have power mainly over the rational mind and intellect. They cannot get hold of the emotions, nor the will, and above all not the will impulses.
That was just a general introduction, and I thought it was worth including, as it sets the scene for the existence of a dimension of being that is non-material, but that is primary, hence the rider of the cab that directs the horse. Later, this will come up in the analogy metaphor that Steiner uses for human beings at spiritual level as being centaurs, as in part human, part animal, and part horse even. But also specifically the warning that the intellect and logic can function apparently very well while at the same time being divorced from reality. That's something that is a difficult pill for myself to swallow, but one I think that I do need to get down me, and because that applies to this whole talk today, that it's not primarily going to be one that is rationally, intellectually, or logically driven, or at least if it is, then approach with caution. The horse is not the driver.
Above all, people must learn to understand where the boundary between the so-called physical world and the spiritual world lies. This boundary really lies right in the middle of the human being. Precisely this is important for understanding the world. The boundary between the physical world and the spiritual world is found within the human being. I have already explained that the scientific way of thinking was obliged at first to cooperate in producing a certain darkening of the spirit, in support of what the spirits of darkness sought to bring into human thinking since 1879. In the scientific sphere, this is very subtle. Both scientifically trained thinkers and scientific experts who cooperate in the general education of our age and in the formation of the world view are compelled to divert human beings from perceiving the boundary that exists within them between the physical world and the spiritual world. It can be shown schematically that, for instance, any nerve, say a nerve of touch, carries the sensation of touch to the spinal cord, yellow in the diagram. The sensations from the periphery of the body reach the spinal cord. Then, from another point of the spinal cord, the so-called motor nerve goes out and the impulse of the will is sent on. In the brain, this is shown in a more complicated way, as if the nerves were like telegraph wires. A sense impression on the skin is led to the central organ, and from there an order goes out, as it were, that a movement must be carried out. For instance, a fly settles somewhere on the body, causing a sensation. The sensation is led to the central organ, and there the organ is given to lift the hand to the forehead to chase away the fly. This is an idea that is generally accepted today. A future age will look on this concept as something very comical, for it is comical indeed for those who can comprehend the facts. But it is an idea that is accepted by the majority of professional scientists. The reality is far more difficult to grasp than the primitive comparisons with telegraph wires. Spiritual science alone enables us to understand the reality. An impulse of the will has nothing to do with a process described in so childish a way as an order going out from a physical central organ. It is only a bodily reflection of a complicated spiritual reality, of course. This boundary exists in us in a very remarkable way. When we enter into a relationship with the world around us, this process is connected with the part of the nerve cord that goes as far as the interruption. Yet as soul beings, we must also have a link with our own physical body. This connection with our own physical body is transmitted through the other part of the nerve cord. It is quite out of the question that such infantile ideas correspond to any form of reality, ideas that presuppose that the soul is to be found somewhere between the sensory and the motor nerves, where it receives an impression from the exterior world and transmits an order from there, like a telegraph operator. This childish idea, which we see again and again, is very strange when found in conjunction with the demand that science must at all costs avoid being anthropomorphic. People demand that we not be anthropomorphic, yet they do not realize how anthropomorphic they themselves are when they say that an impression is received, an order is sent out, and so on. They talk and talk and have not the slightest idea what a mythological nature they dream up about the human organism. They would realize it if they took things seriously.
Well, the age-old question of fate and free will. where do our responses arise from? A fly lands on my forehead, I raise my arm to swat the fly or wave it away. The scientific view that Steiner's describing there is this of telegraph operator sending signals. The nervous system receives the sensation, sends the signal to the spinal cord, to the central organ of the brain, which then sends a signal, a command signal, to the arm to raise up and wave away the fly. All very mechanical. In this particular example, very obviously a reaction that could be completely reflexive and automatic. A machine could be programmed to react to sensations in this way. The question Steiner's raising, and it's a little difficult for me to understand, some of when he's talking about the scientific view he considers absurd and the much more complex spiritual scientific view, which is that the soul, that it is a boundary, that the human being exists on the boundary between the physical and the non-physical dimensions, so the boundary between the soul and the body, and that it's in this space in between that will emerges out of. So if we are not to be simply reacting mechanistically in this reductionist scientific model, which is all predetermined, then it's the divine intervention from another dimension of the soul as it experiences contact with the limits of physical reality. In the example of the fly, it's just a random example, but any sensation that the body, the nervous system experiences, signifies literally and symbolically this boundary between the internal dimension of the soul, the non-physical realm, and the external realm of the apparent physical. The surface of our skin being, as I say, both a metaphor for and a kind of a literal case of the boundary between the soul and physical reality, which it is responding to with an act of will. This seems to be the central question that Stein is exploring here in the relationship between this and the realm of the living and the realm of the dead in two ways. One, that the realm of the dead is a non-physical realm where it is all feeling and will-based, where the realm of the living, we're mostly captured by the sensations of the physical reality. And the other way in which this is central to what he's exploring is that the way that a living human being, if it's fully conscious and or enlightened, exists on the threshold between the physical and the non-physical, between the realm of the living and the dead. So that boundary there between the soul and the world is also the boundary between the living and the dead, roughly, if I got it right.
Now the question arises, why then is the nerve cord interrupted? It is interrupted because otherwise we would not be included in the whole process. Only because at the point of interruption the impulse springs over the gap, so to speak, are we connected to both the world and this impulse. If the entire process were uninterrupted with no break at this point, it would be a process of nature in which we would not participate. The ideas ruling today are nothing other than ideas serving the impulses of the spirits of darkness. The boundary between physical and spiritual experience lies within the human being. We are again aware of the will when the hand moves, when we have a sensation from another side. Sleep continually extends anatomically, physiologically, into our waking life. We are connected with the exterior, physical world, but are awake only with the part of our being that goes as far as the interruption of the nerves. We sleep through what lies in us beyond this interruption in the nerves, even by day. In the present stage of the development of the earth, this process is not yet physical. It takes place on a certain spiritual level, although it is connected to a great extent with the lower qualities of human nature.
Okay, what did he just say? That is the question. Something about how we sleep even while we awake, that we are only awake during the day to the part of existence that extends into our bodies. So our consciousness, we are conscious of the area of our experience where the nerves are interrupted, that's to say, where we physically interface with physical reality through our bodies. But there's another dimension of our being that isn't restricted to sensational experience, and that extends outside the periphery of the circumference of the nerve endings, really improvising madly now, that is effectively asleep because we're not aware of what it's experiencing in our conscious minds. I'm pretty sure that this, what he's describing or trying to describe there, what I'm trying to understand, relates to things that Deva Shan has talked about and to how the body itself is embedded in a much larger field of perceptual and cognitive experience than can be contained by the nerve endings, by the nervous system itself. But we are only able to perceive and recognize that aspect of being that is registered by our nervous system, which is what we think of as physical reality. Simplified for dummies, there's a realm of our experience which is non-physical, or at least much more subtly physical, which he's referring to as spiritual realm of our experience, that it hasn't yet landed or incarnated or become physically manifest, and so we're asleep to it. It's as if it's happening while we're asleep, even though we're awake. And most confusing of all, perhaps, this realm of suppressed or unaccessed, subtler spiritual experience that we're embedded in and participating in outside of our realm of ordinary consciousness, corresponds most closely with the lower aspects of our nature, which, as he'll get into soon, is our animal instincts, the horse part of the centaur.
However, I have often expounded the secret that the human being's lower nature connects precisely with the higher manifestations of certain spiritual beings. If we were to note all the places in the human being where the nerves are interrupted and draw them in a diagram, we would obtain a diagram of the boundary between experiencing in the physical world and experiencing in the higher world. The spiritual world directly forms and creates everything that lies below the point of interruption in the nerves. These things may be difficult to understand when you hear them for the first time.
No shit.
But they should make you aware that you cannot work with the more intimate questions of knowledge of the human being without certain difficulties. Think of the plant world. The plants grow out of the earth, but they would not do so unless they received forces from the cosmos that are intimately connected with the life of the sun and forces generated by the earth. All these cosmic forces, everything that pours in from the universe out of the sun's life, together with all that emanates from the earth, belongs to the life of the plants. This joint action of cosmic and telluric, or earthly forces, is part of the life and existence in the physical world as we must understand it. What the plant assimilates from the soil through its roots, we human beings take from the earth in a more delicate way, through our eyes and ears, and above all through our skin. Human beings are earthly beings through their nerves, through the form of telluric or earthly forces in the air they breathe, and through the food that the earth gives them. Human beings receive earthly forces through their organs in a refined way, while the plant receives them in a coarser way, through its roots. The plant receives yet other forces as well. It receives forces that stream in from the sun's sphere, from the heavenly sphere, the sphere of the cosmic spaces or universe. Human beings draw out of their bodies what the plants draw out of the universe. Human beings take from the earth in a more refined state the forces and substances that the plant assimilates more coarsely from the soil through its roots. The forces in which the so-called dead are embedded play much more intensely into this life than we imagine. As human beings, we are formed so that the threshold between the everyday physical world and the spiritual world goes right through the middle of the human being. If we contemplate our everyday life, which we considered the last time more from the physical side and today more from the side of the soul, then we may say, while we are incarnated here in the physical body, we have active in us everything that can be experienced through the senses, everything spread out around us as a tapestry of matter about which we receive information through our senses. We then build upon this sense world, which we are also able to penetrate independently in our thought life. When we unite the sense life and the thought life, we have basically everything that constitutes our usual waking consciousness. From the moment we awaken in the morning until the moment we fall asleep, we are truly awake only in our sense impressions and in our thinking. We are not fully awake in our feeling life. And there lies the threshold, practically unnoticed by everyday consciousness, between the thought life and the feeling life. For we are not conscious at all of what penetrates our feeling life as a deeper reality. We are conscious of the feelings themselves. They surge up out of a subconscious world. But we are conscious of them no more than we are of our dreams when we are asleep. As I said recently here in Switzerland, in public lectures, while we live in our feeling life, we are actually sleep and dreaming. The dream life extends itself over into our waking life. We are really in a continuous dream state from the moment of going to sleep to that of awakening. But we are only conscious of those dreams that are most strongly connected with our physical existence. Only in the deeper layers of our consciousness do we sleep, so to say, dreamlessly. But this dreaming and dreamless sleep life goes over into our feeling life, into the life of our emotions. And we know no more of the reality, of the actual content of the ordinary consciousness of our feeling life, than we know of what actually occurs when we dream at night. Therefore, we could also say in these lectures that the human being does not inwardly experience the content of what is called history with waking consciousness, but dreams through it. History is a cosmic dream of the human being, for the impulses living in history actually live in feeling and emotional impulses. We dream while we experience history. Thus the life of feeling lies beneath the threshold of the actual waking consciousness. Also in this soul connection, the boundary between the conscious and the subconscious life goes through the middle of the human being. Let me read that again. Thus I accentuate it once more, also in the soul connection, the threshold between the actual physical world of waking life and the world that remains lies in the middle of the human being. Now everything we experience, between death and a new birth plays right into our life of the feeling and the will, that is, into what we sleep and dream through. The experiences of the dead are actually in the world where we live in feeling and willing. Only we do not know, with our ordinary consciousness, the realities that live in feeling and willing. If we could live through the reality of the feeling life, and especially the reality of the willing life, just as in waking we live through the reality of the sense perceptions and the thought conceptions, the conceptions to a lesser degree, then those who have died would be just as much in continual connection with us as someone who is with us here on the physical plane. And we would be able to receive impressions from the dead in our waking consciousness through our senses and thought life. What is living in the impulses of the dead juts continually into our feeling life and into the life of our will impulses. And only because we miss it by dreaming and sleeping through it do we feel separated from the dead.
Simply put, then, if we were more completely aware of our feeling experience, our felt sense of being alive, the sensations and the feelings and the impulses within us, we would also be aware of the realm of the dead and the communications from the dead. Even there, that seems to be saying too much, the word communication. When we experience an impulse or a sensation, that's not necessarily communication, or to call it communication then raises the question of what's communicating to what. There's a continuum there, just as there's a continuum in our awareness between sensation, thought, feeling and will. But somewhere on that continuum, we fall asleep, we go offline, and so we don't retrieve the memories, or we don't store the memories of, we don't process the experience in such a way that it gets incorporated into the other aspect of our being, which is the cognitive, perceptual, the sensational cognitive area, which is what we think of as waking life. And I think it's illustrative to juxtapose these descriptions by Steiner, which are borderline incomprehensible because they're so demanding, they're so outside of the ordinary framework for understanding existence, to juxtapose them with Whitley Strieber's accounts of his dead wife Anne communicating with him, which are typical of the kind of stories that people tell when they have psychic interactions with the dead. And the contrast is obvious. I mean, one is not so credible, another is more credible, but that also what I wanted to point out, that dog's really getting on my nerves, is that the more easily comprehensible it is, the less credible it becomes, and vice versa, although of course something being incomprehensible doesn't make it credible necessarily. But if it is meaningful and it has the sense of the real that Steiner's accounts do for me, but at the same time it's very difficult to comprehend mentally, then that combination suggests that it's representing a reality, whereas Strieber's things are all too easy to understand, but they're very difficult to believe, or it's very dangerous to believe them, I think. And that this in itself relates to the danger of experiencing these other realms of awareness while keeping one's mental mind, self, or false identity intact. That really the only way to experience these other dimensions of our totality, which intersect with the realm of the dead, in a way that's wholesome and grounded, is through a kind of transformation of awareness that these other perceptions are dependent on, as opposed to Strieber's route, which was to have these wild experiences and then somewhat be transformed by them, I would say in a distorted way, to be deranged by them. That's putting the cart before the horse again, letting the intellect lead. The other way, the Devarshana way, is that through a process of enlightened embodiment, we become more in tune with the sensations and what's underneath the sensations, which is the feelings, the unconscious, and the will and the impulses in the that are emerged through the organism. What is driving the horse, in other words, and thereby start to become cognizant of other dimensions of existence.
Fundamentally, however, the world of the so-called dead is quite different from the world of those incarnated in the physical body. Ask yourself in a thought-filled way, what then exists for the waking, non-clairvoyant consciousness from the time of waking until going to sleep? The answer is only what we experience in the world, which is spread out as a tapestry of sense impressions, and the world we fashion out of this sense world through our thought conceptions. In the first place, everything of this world, belonging to the so-called mineral kingdom, which we perceive with our sense organs, does not exist directly for the dead. The stars, the sun, and the moon, for example, belong to this mineral world. In general, everything belongs to it that is perceptible to the senses. A large region of the plant world belongs to it also. These are primarily regions that do not lie open to the spiritual and soul eyes of the dead. On the other hand, the soul eyes of the dead are open to the world that we are more or less conscious of, which is veiled by the sense world, that is to say, the world of impulses, of the forces living in the animals. This is the lowest world for the dead, in exactly the same way that the mineral world is the lowest world for us here in the physical body. Just as, for us, the plant world sprouts forth and builds itself up out of the mineral kingdom, so for the dead, the human world builds itself as a soul world out of the foundation of the animal world. And just as the animal kingdom forms the third category for us, based upon the mineral and plant world, so the kingdom of the angels, archangels, and so on, forms a higher kingdom for the dead. Therefore, the dead exist in a different environment than that of human beings living in physical bodies. Just imagine for a moment how it would be if everything you perceive with the senses, about which you form concepts in your physical body, were taken out of the physical world. There would remain, for non-clairvoyant perception, something that can only look like a dream world. It would appear like a world that can only be dreamt, that cannot live any more strongly in the consciousness than a dream. The dead have no such condition. They feel that everything they do in their environment, be it merely pointing a finger, causes joy or pain. I am describing this quite symbolically and pictorially. They do not enter at all into relationship with their surroundings without awakening everywhere an echo of joy and pain. If you do something after you have passed through the portals of death, your actions always bring about pain or joy somewhere, a tension or relaxation of something that is similar to the feeling life. If we knock on a table, we feel that it does not cause the table pain. The dead can never carry out an action without knowing that they live and weave not only in a living element, but also in a living element filled with feeling. The feeling-filled stimulus is spread out over their entire environment. The dead learn to know this world from all sides, through having to penetrate step by step all the secrets that here on earth are concealed from them, just as what slumbers beneath their feeling life is concealed from their souls, for it is the same thing.
A living, feeling environment that the dead exist in. Everything is responsive. There is no boundary between the consciousness of the dead and the environment that they're in. So any interaction that they have with it causes a contraction of tension or the relaxation of joy, pain or joy. Total consequences, total responsibility. As compared to the realm of the living, which they have left behind, which is the what we think of as the physical world, the world of objects, so the sun and the moon and the earth and the sky and fire and water and bodies and loving cuddles and warm radiators and all the rest of it. Now, the idea of saying goodbye to the physical world through death is a wrenching one in and of itself, but the other aspect there is what's on the other side of that goodbye. What is one saying hello to? One is returning to a realm of being in which one has no filters anymore, and one can see all of the things that one wasn't able to see because of the distraction of the sense-based physical world while one was in a body, that the where one's perceptions ended with one's nerve endings. They were interrupted by the nervous system. So essentially one had the luxury of being in existence without experiencing immediately the living consequences of all of our thoughts and actions, but at the same time we were cut off from the totality of our existence. The dead, as Stein is describing it, are reintroduced to the totality of themselves, or at least have that potential. All the things that were kept secret from them, they have the opportunity to uncover, but this, by the same token, they can no longer hide from the truth of themselves and their actions. In sleep and sensation. So I wonder if this is why I'm always dreaming about eating things, and I mean particularly food, but obviously I mean dreams in general, as Steiner says, the ones we remember, the ones that correspond more closely with our physical lives. I become more aware of how I'm dreaming a lot about ordinary mundane things. Last night I dreamt about this woman opening a box and there was a cookie in it, or it was a woman's box, but I opened it and took a cookie out and bit into it, and it was orange flavored and ginger flavored, and it was so intensely real, the flavor of that biscuit cookie, and it led to this overwhelming sensation, feeling of grief, of sorrow, that was sweet as well as painful, kind of a sweet anguish that was so intense that it woke me up, which is a recurring experience. But what's not so usual is that it was triggered by this encounter with the most mundane aspect of physical existence, i.e. eating a cookie. There's a threshold there.
Granted, such a question as the one I now intend to interject cannot count as a properly scientific one, but it can, nevertheless, point towards something behind which real relationships exist. We can ask, why then the power of the all-penetrating world wisdom has concealed some things from the human being here in the physical world? We can ask, why the mysteries of the building up of the whole animal world into which the dead must be initiated is concealed. Precisely when we attempt to answer such a question, we reach into the deepest mysteries of existence. One of the most astonishing and impressive experiences that can be made in the circle of the dead is to discover that just as here there are smiths, joiners, and others who work in the world of mechanics and handwork, and thereby create the physical, sense-perceptible foundation of life here, so in the spirit realm the dead work, beginning with the animal kingdom on upward. While the animal kingdom here, in many respects, is seen as inferior, with the mineral world lying still lower, the very basis of the work of the dead is the furthering of the animal kingdom. Therefore the dead immerse themselves in all the skillfulness that is concealed from them in the life between birth and death.
Well, my experiences with Garbanzo, with cats in general, and dogs sometimes, Harry, but most specifically with Garbanzo, in the years leading up to his death, where I became aware of a deeper dimension to his being that corresponded with my own soul, that seemed as though this cat was a part of my soul that had incarnated through a cat, because it wasn't able to fully incarnate when I was born, and that what seemed like a cat was a much higher, more advanced being than even I was aware of being as a human being. Whatever was going on there anyway, you can listen to the podcast with Venetia that I did about it. There seems to be some correspondences here, in that my strongest and clearest sense of who I am as a soul being, and how my awareness extends beyond this physical realm into the realm where the dead are, was through my connection to Garbanzo. And the experience I had was that I was becoming more human through knowing him. I was accessing deeper aspects of my own soul being nature, learning to love. And by the same token, because Garbanzo was the object of my love, he himself was transforming, individuating, growing, evolving through my loving attention, and becoming more and more ensouled, more and more evolved as a being. So it was a mutually symbiotic relationship that had to do somehow with redeeming the animal part of myself, or raising it up to a more spiritual or a more conscious dimension of being. Something like that, anyway. And he's just trying to articulate it now in a slightly different context because of this mystery that Steiner's exploring here, the relation between the realm of the dead, the work of the dead, the process of spiritual evolution for the living, and interaction with the kingdom of the beast.
We come here to the point that was held more or less secret until our age by the brotherhoods that believed, partly justly and partly unjustly, that other human beings were not ready for such things. If you gain the knowledge of what is related to the animal nature in the world of the dead, you then see that all this is the feeling-filled living element. Human beings also have this feeling-filled living element in their souls, but in what way? Between birth and death, for that is where it exists, they possess this element in such a way that were it not locked up in their unconsciousness, they could at every moment employ it for the destruction of the remainder of this living element in the world. Just imagine what that really means.
Just imagine. The feeling-filled living element pertains to the realm of the dead and the intersection between the animal kingdom and the realm of the dead and the inner unaccessed life of the soul of all human beings. That is the secret of secrets, because if we could access it in this life, it would give us the potential to destroy the living feeling element, existence itself. Sounds like a plot for a Chris Nolan movie.
You have in your personal life a feeling-filled living element that is enclosed in the boundaries of the physical human being. If human beings were generally to have this element freely at their disposal, then they could employ these concealed forces at any time to destroy the feeling-filled living element around them. The animal nature in the human being is primarily, even in the best sense, a destructive one. And when human beings have passed through death's door, it is their task, above all, to tear out of their soul all the impulses that have then become free, so that a great deal of desire to destroy the living, to kill the living, remains. And it can be said that to have respect and reverence for all living things is something that the departed must learn above all. This reverence for everything living is something that can be looked upon as the self-evident development of the dead.
Self-evident, I presume, because the living feeling element which the dead are embedded in consciously, as opposed to ourselves, the living, or unconscious of it, is that we cannot even look at a thing or think a thing or in any way engage with anything around us without affecting it profoundly, whether with contraction or relaxation, whether with pain or joy. So that instant reciprocity that compels us to into a full awareness of our accountability, the consequences of not just our actions but our thoughts and even our attention. There's a realm of the dead in which it's only possible to withstand that kind of awareness through a developing of absolute reverence, compassion for everything and everyone that one is engaged with. One is inseparable from the living feeling element of existence. The kingdom of the beast stuff as far as I can see, that it's inherently destructive, relates to, on the one hand, esoterically, the whole Christian archetype of Satan and the Beast 666, which I've spent most of my life exploring one way or another in different ways, including personally and directly with my own weird relationship with cats and women and the violence in my soul that I've been trying to purge or purify, and then the more profane Darwinian aspect of the beast, which is predators, kill or be killed, survival instincts, that the nature at that level, animal nature, is inherently destructive or requires the ability to destroy and has a savagery to it, a ferociousness that takes delight in destruction. I explored this in my Sam Peckinpah novel, but all of my work one way or another.
After death, we feel ourselves surging with life in this relationship with other souls. We live out our life of feeling and will as human beings between birth and death, without knowing that the souls of the dead live in the waves of this life of feeling and will, which we sleep through and dream away. The dead are always there. They live in the waves of our own feeling and will, and they live there in such a way that they experience this life with us. While we experience the surrounding world through our senses as something external, the dead live in the impulses of our feelings and will. They are far more intimately bound together with us than we, as far as we are physically embodied, are bound together with our surroundings.
The dead live in the world created through our feelings and will impulses. Suggests that we shape the world of the dead, the so-called afterlife, while we're alive, not just for ourselves, that we die into it, but for others who are already there and dead, who are experiencing the consequences of our actions in the present in a way that we don't get to experience them until later.
It is so that this life, or better, this experiencing, this inner presence in life of the dead, develops gradually in accordance with the conditions that were developed during our life here. We truly live together with all souls after death, this is true, but we know nothing about it. Relationships set in slowly and gradually with souls that we were connected with during our life between birth and death. We cannot form new, original relationships with other human beings during the life between death and a new birth. We cannot begin new connections directly. When we have loved or hated someone here on earth, when we were connected with them, either in a positive or in a negative way, this again rises from a gray spiritual depth in the gradual awakening of the life after death.
Brings to mind my neighbor Dale in Canada, who's no longer my neighbor, happily, but also other neighbors I've had in the past. I've had hateful, antagonistic relationship with neighbors throughout my life, and a neighbor is, well, because it's a Christian idea, love thy neighbor. Neighbors are the easiest people to hate because they're very close to us just by sheer circumstances. There's no choice involved, there's no family thing, it's just circumstances. And anyway, I like to think that if I feel real antagonism for somebody and I have contempt for them, that pushes them away. That's what it seems to serve to do in this life. But it's actually a much stronger connection, the antagonism, the hostility, the anger, the resentment, than a neutral relationship. Whether we have very strong positive feelings, whether I have very strong positive feelings or strong negative feelings, in either case, it's a tie is created. And so and it's why Sartre said, hell is other people. We're going to have to cohabitate the realm of before birth and after death realm with all the souls that we've forged a tie with, including the ones that we most loathe, at least until we sort that stuff out. It's a word to the wise. Have good neighborly relations. It's in your own interests.
Thus a great part of this experiencing, of this inner life presence of the dead, formed by our connections with other souls during our most recent incarnations, gradually emerges out of a gray spiritual depth. You can now easily imagine that first there are the direct relationships present, and then the indirect relationships. However, because all souls are more or less connected with one another over all the earth, and during our long life between death and a new birth we form, indirectly at least, many new connections, we human beings have extensive experience with other souls, if we also take into account the indirect relationships. Even when we are here on earth, we have already within us this living into other souls. In the spiritual world, we have lived together with innumerable souls, over and over again. The feeling of being at one with all souls, which an abstract philosophy considers only as an abstract at-oneness, has its quite concrete side. There are scarcely any souls over the whole earth with whom we do not have at least a distant, indirect connection. We must grasp this fact as concretely as possible, and then this will lead us to something real.
Little puppet thing, got you hanging from their strings. Little puppet thing, got you dancing in their face. The strings can move you to any place to make you do what the good little puppets do. And your pencil's nose outgrows Pinocchio.
If we can grasp this fact as concretely as possible, then it may lead us to something real. Words are useless unless they are part of the means by which we are led to reality. The fantasy of at-one-ment, that we're all united in a single heavenly tapestry of consciousness, that has been perverted and asinined into a New Age paradigm. And even the Christian idea of heaven, being reunited with our loved ones in heaven, long before the New Age came out with its version, is a nice idea, and that's about it. And because it's so insufficient as a means to grasp the concrete reality that we're in avoidance of but trying to get back to, it conjures forth a corresponding shadow fantasy of hell, of eternal damnation, of being trapped in a confined space with all the souls that we find most repugnant, and the demons of hell writhing naked in a Zion-like mosh pit of unfulfilled, unsatiable needs, desires, fears, loathings, etc. Hell is other people, but then heaven is other souls too, so what's the difference? Our superego or id, we either get to sit on the right hand side of Christ, or we end up with Satan's pitchfork up our butt. When the reality is something that's not just after death but prior to birth, it's the eternal bookends that this life is held up by and supported by, and it's continuous with this life, just that this life we have this brief tiny window of luxury, of unawareness, of sleeping, of amnesia, whereby we don't experience our interconnectivity with others, and so we create these stories that point towards them. But at the level of feeling, sensation, will, and impulse, where no stories take hold, we're already experiencing the repercussions that go back to the beginning of time and that extend forward to the end of history. We're riding the wave of those consequences, and we are. It's ourselves we are. The consequences of those waves. Oh. So anyway.
What the dead experience is a gradual waking up into a world based, in a wider sense, on their karma. An inward brightness increases more and more, spreading over this world as our experiences become richer in this second realm built upon the animal realm. Just as our experiences with the plant realm are built on the mineral realm, our experiences become ever richer and richer. Imagine this experience extending into all concrete connections, and you will grasp something of what permeates the soul of the departed between death and a new birth. All thoughts that connect us karmically in any way with other souls are bound up with this experience. In this lies an infinitely rich world. Essentially, during the first half of this life, between death and a new birth, we are increasingly filled with wisdom. If human beings always had a full survey of the wisdom that they can acquire soon after death, then there would be countless human beings who would prefer to cover up the traces of their existence rather than to enter into new lives. What we have in common with the realm of the dead springs forth actively out of our feeling life and out of the life of the will impulses. What springs forth in this way, and what we ourselves do without our consciousness by dreaming and sleeping through it, forms our destiny. We ourselves are this. We dream and sleep through all we do in molding our own destiny. We wake in what we experience as our destiny, but only because it remains subconscious. What is it that remains, in reality, subconscious? What remains subconscious comes across as impulses out of earlier incarnations on earth, and out of the life between death and a new birth, in a purely spiritual way, from where the dead are found. We dream and sleep through it. At the same time, these are forces that come also from ourselves. They are the forces with which we mold our destiny. We weave our destiny out of the same realm that the dead inhabit in common with us. Think how we grow together with this world, of which we now know to a certain extent, how we sleep through it and how we experience it, although we have not yet spoken of the experiences in connection with the beings of the higher hierarchies. This will also be considered, but what I wish to convey through a discussion is that we must place the realm of the so-called dead within the same realm where we ourselves live, and that we become conscious of the fact that we feel separated from the dead, though in reality we are not, only because we dream and sleep through our feeling life and will life where the dead also are. Why do we not notice this other world? Because we turn our gaze toward the events that occur in our life and in our surroundings, and not toward the events that do not occur, to the events that are continually being prevented. When human beings have gone through the portal of death, they do not cease to be active within the human community. They continue to be active, although in a different way than when they were active here in the physical body. We live under the illusion that our actions are our own, because they flow out of our feelings and our impulses of will. In reality, they flow right into our daily life, out of the deeds of those who have died.
Okay, so our actions that we think are our own flow out of the actions of the dead of those who came before us. This is, I think, what Dave Oshana is pointing towards when he talks of the ancestors and how any idea we have that we exist separately from our ancestors is erroneous, and we need to get over it, get past it, in order to get closer to reality. Central to the false identity delusion that we are the master of our own destinies and we are acting autonomously out of self-will, out of personal desire and so on. That whole complex or cluster of erroneous assumptions is potentially dissolved in and by the awareness that's in the blood and in the cells of the body, ironically, because it's our connection to the dead, to the ancestors who are dead, and yet they're still alive in us, in our blood, that what we think of as our lived lives, our personal history, is in fact a continuation of a larger life that is our ancestry, our parents, our grandparents, and so on, back in fanning out into more and more human beings that came before us. And that extends inevitably into the collective, just as our ancestors eventually meet, mingle and merge with everyone else's ancestors until it starts narrowing back to a single point again, whether literally we come from the same set of parents or figuratively, it's not worth trying to figure out, but that we all come from a common source, a shared source and root, and therefore our personal history is a collective history, and history itself, this attempt to create a narrative out of something that is everything, the incarnation of the human being in many multiple forms, the countless lived lives, all of which are part of a single tapestry. And the idea we have of history, which is of also of destiny, as some story that is being narrated and being driven by individuals, by autonomous agents, Ironically, paradoxically, this is putting the cart before the horse, or the horse before the rider, because actually there is no history and there is no destiny without man. There's no separation between the human consciousness and the destiny that is woven out of that consciousness. Just as there's no clear dividing line between individual humans and collective humanity, there's one incarnation. I don't know if that makes much sense, but then I don't suppose it could make sense. Hopefully it makes a sensation, and the sensation is closer to the reality, which is the destiny of anatomy of history unfolding through the actions which we perform, potentially as a means to fulfill not just our destiny, but the feeling will of our ancestry, and all the way back to the original ancestor, the original source, the original impulse, and the original will. Thy will be done.
In our future development, it will be crucial to know that when we do something connected with our life in community with other human beings, we do this together with the dead. But, of course, such a consciousness, related essentially to the feeling life and the will life, must be grasped also by the feeling and the will. We will never be able to grasp this with dry, abstract ideas. Please understand this clearly. When you read to so-called living people, you know that they understand what you read to them. But the dead live within the contents of the words themselves. The dead live in each word that you read to them. They penetrate into what passes through your own mind and soul, Gemüt.
Did you hear that too?
The dead live with you more intensely than was ever possible for them in the life on earth. If we understand this fact, we can develop community with the dead. This community with the dead is really a very intimate one, intensified by a seeing consciousness. If we enter consciously into the realm we inhabit together with the dead, when you read or recite to the dead, you hear what you are reading from the dead person, like a spiritual echo. We must become acquainted with ideas like these if we wish to gain a real conception of the concrete spiritual world. Things are different in the spiritual world than they are here.
Why does he pronounce the word spiritual weird? Spiritual. Spiritual. I can't even do it.
Here you can hear yourself speak when you are speaking, or you know that you are thinking when you think. If you speak to or begin a thinking relationship with the dead, your words or the thoughts you send come to you out of the dead themselves, if you consciously perceive your connection with the dead. And when you send a message to the dead, you feel as if you are intimately connected with the departed person. If a reply comes, at first you are vaguely conscious that the departed one is speaking, and you must now draw out of your own soul what has been spoken. This will make you realize how necessary it is for a real spiritual communication to hear from the other one what you yourself think and conceive, and to hear from out of yourself what the other one says. This is a kind of inversion of the entire relationship between one being and another, but this inversion takes place when we really enter the spiritual world. Because the spiritual world is so entirely different from the physical, and because, since about the 15th century, people want to form conceptions based only on the physical world, they displace and obstruct their entrance to the spiritual world. If people would only realize that a world can exist that is in many respects the direct opposite of what they call the true world, if they would be willing to form ideas, which perhaps appear absurd from a materialistic perspective, then they would transform their souls and have the ability to see into the spiritual world always around us. It is not that human beings, through their nature, are truly separated from the spiritual world. Through habit and circumstances of inheritance, they have become entirely unaccustomed, since the 14th and 15th centuries, to forming non-materialistic ideas. This applies even to art.
Please note, even artists are locked into a materialistic perspective. This obviously applies to science, but then also to religion, ironically, and occultism, that we are in a materialist paradigm to the point that we can't even recognize that we've excluded the hidden reflective dimension that Steiner refers to as spiritual. We have these words that we use, of course, so we think that we're referring to it, but in actual fact we're not. This may relate to how we've conflated or confused the psychic realms with the spiritual, because psychic dimensions are also physical, i.e. material.
As we feel, in a certain sense, that the human being proceeds from the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, so the deceased feel themselves held and carried by the hierarchies above them.
Enter the Angeloi. Wow, this reminds me of something I was going to mention, which was Dave O'Shana once said that he did an event, I think it was in Finland, he talked a lot about the ancestors, and somebody took him aside afterwards and asked him why he didn't talk more about angels. And Dave said, well, I have experience of ancestors, but I don't have experience of angels. Dave said that he said that anyway. And lately I've been thinking about that and wondering if it's really true. I can't see how Dave, the enlightened O'Shana, could not have experience with angels, but I suspect that what most people refer to as angels when they talk about angelic this and that has little or nothing to do with what Dev O'Shana or an enlightened being experiences or encounters that correspond with the reality of angels. That's my guess.
The way the human being gradually becomes familiar with this kingdom of the higher beings can be described as a letting go of oneself. Again, we must understand these things in a way that cannot be based in the physical world of the senses. In growing up from childhood in the sense world, we gradually become acquainted first with our nearest surroundings and then with the wider world, and so on. We become acquainted with things in such a way that we know that they approach us little by little. This is not the case between death and a new birth. From the moment we know that we are connected with the Angeloi, we feel as if we had been united with them since eternity. And yet we feel we can only develop our consciousness by separating the idea of the Angeloi from ourselves to a certain extent. Here in the physical world we experience by taking up ideas. But in the spiritual world, we experience by separating the ideas from ourselves.
This is a key point.
We know that we carry them within us and are entirely filled by them, but we must separate them from ourselves to bring them to consciousness. And so, we set free the ideas of Angeloi, Arch-Angeloi, and Archai.
The Angeloi that can be named is not the true Angeloi, and so bang goes thousands of years of occult rituals. If you can summon it, you don't want to.
In the lowest kingdom, the deceased are, so to speak, connected with the animal nature, which they must strive to master. Then comes the realm of the souls with whom they are directly or indirectly karmically connected. In this kingdom, the dead experience the relationship with the Angaloi. The relationship with the kingdom of the Angaloi helps create a right connection with the kingdom of human souls. Hence, in the life between death and a new birth, it is difficult to distinguish between the experiences with other human souls and those with the Angaloi. Human beings have an active relationship with the Angaloi, although these things are merely comparisons and indications, just as here in our physical life our memory leads us back to something we have experienced, so do the Angaloi lead us to something that we must experience in our life between death and a new birth. The Angaloi are really the mediators for everything arising in the life of the so-called dead. And the Angaloi help the human beings in everything that they must do between death and a new birth, in connection with the conquest of the animal element. For the human beings must raise their own animal nature into the spiritual part of their being to prepare for the next incarnation.
You get that? Raise up the animal. Raise up the animal. The beast, number of the beast, 666, number of the sun, the material sun, the physical sun, behind which the black or invisible sun, 888, Christ, number. This is stuff that, well, I used to write and talk about quite a lot in my Aeolus persona. And now I'm arriving back at the place I started and knowing the place a little bit better this time.
If you grasp this in the right sense, you will say that because we associate with the Angaloi between death and a new birth, we can form the right relationships to the souls with whom we must connect. And because we enter into a connection with the kingdom of the Arch-Angaloi, we can properly prepare the things that must take place during the next incarnation on Earth. The tasks of the Archai, the time spirits, are for both the dead and the living. From my explanations, you will see that the deceased essentially relate to the Angaloi, who regulate their connection to other souls, and to the Arch-Angaloi, who regulate their successive incarnations. But their association with the Archai, they have in common with the so-called living. The dead and the living are embedded in the same way, in something that the spirits of time weave as an unceasing stream of cosmic wisdom and cosmic will activity.
History, destiny, also known as history or destiny. So I feel like I've had experiences of this kind in which I've encountered loved ones who have died in dreams, and there seems to be something behind the personality that I'm encountering, which is a much more enlightened, a much more supersentient, conscious being, even in one case, that of my stepfather, and apparently an angelic being that merely donned the garb of my stepfather, or my memories of my stepfather, maybe both, I don't know, in order to interact with me. So there's a continuum. Who knows, maybe on the other side of things, my stepfather interacted with me and felt like he was interacting with an archangeli. Words are tricky and sticky. Don't get stuck on them. Look into your own felt sense experience of these things, because you can be sure that you have it.
What the spirits of time weave is history, the ethical, moral life of an age, the social life of an age. We might say that we can look into the spiritual kingdom and realize that the so-called dead are there. What they experience in this kingdom is regulated by the Angaloi and Arch-Angaloi. What the dead experience in common with the so-called living is woven by the Archai. Thus we cannot fulfill any fruitful work in the social, historical and ethical moral life unless we realize that this work must come from an element we share with the dead, the element of the archai, or time spirits. In the life of our feelings and of our will, we live in the same spheres with the so-called dead.
It is here, I think, that the juxtaposition of the ancestors with the angle eyes justified, in that just as we allow ourselves to see and experience and embody the reality that we're extensions of our ancestors, this isn't the end but the beginning of a process of acknowledgement and acquiescence to a greater super sensate or super sensitive, whatever the word he uses, reality of lived feeling essence, that we are the current spatio-temporal hub or probe of a vast protuberance of consciousness that extends back and forward in time and space through the ancestral line and into the angelic kingdoms, and that is rooted or grounded like a lightning rod in the animal kingdom, the human body with its animal attributes. Hence the function of our destiny, our purpose here is to ground the angelic and the ancestral line fully in the terrestrial realm, in the animal realm, and by the same token to raise up, refine, and redeem the beast, the bestial. In time for the relinquishment of flesh and blood. I'm not too happy with that sentence. Can you wrestle with these concepts? Do you want to? Are you falling into a trap? Millennia in the making. Do we have to handle knowledge? Yes, I think we do. It's man's Promethean gift. We've been given fire. We have to know how to use it, otherwise we're just going to burn our houses down. A little knowledge is a very dangerous thing, but none at all is fatal.
Let us first form a conception of what is really behind the life of our senses from an exterior perspective. We can picture the sense impressions as if they were spread out before us like a carpet. Of course, we must imagine that this carpet also contains the impressions of all of the 12 senses, such as we know them through anthroposophy. This carpet of sense impressions covers a reality lying behind the senses to a certain extent. This reality lying behind the sense perceptions must not be imagined as the scientist imagines the world of atoms, nor as a certain philosophical, quote, thing in itself, close quote. In my public lectures, I have emphasized that when we look for the thing in itself, as is done by modern philosophers, such as Kant, this would be similar to breaking a mirror to find the reality of the beings we see in the mirror. I do not speak in this sense of something physical behind the sense perceptions. What I mean is something spiritual in which we ourselves are embedded, but that we cannot reach with our usual consciousness between birth and death.
I think one of the things that draws me to this material at this particular time in my life, besides mere serendipity and Mike B's recommendation, is that it's the kind of description that I want to hear more from Dave O'Shana, that it gives me a much more tangible sense of what enlightenment is, what it signifies, what it means, what it would be like, why it exists, what the difference is between my perception and Dave's perception, between an unenlightened and an enlightened perception and experience of existing. Does this veil of the physical senses and the sensate physical world, and there's this idea that there is another world hidden behind it, and if I can just break through storm heaven, break the mirror, and I can get through, whereas in fact I know this is not true, and I know from experience it doesn't work, because in fact I'm embedded in the world that I'm trying to access. So it's not a question of trying to get into it or to get rid of something that prevents me from seeing it, although it's closer to that latter, but more something much subtler, journey of zero distance, by which I can start to apprehend existence at a subsensory level. But to do so, I have to go not bypass the senses, but go all the way into and through the senses, which is a journey of zero distance, because the nerve endings, well, I'm already at the end of my nerve endings as consciousness. Well, I suppose this is debatable. This is where Dave, his model of actually consciousness having to get fully landed in the body and fully distributed throughout all the body has to do, I think, with what Steiner's talking about, of filling up the nervous system so totally that we are at the limits of the nervous system, at the nerve endings, and then passing through that infinitesimal threshold into the non-sensory dimensions where our nerves cannot follow.
If we could reach the first stage of spiritually solving the riddle contained in the carpet of sense perceptions, so that outside we could see more than the manifold impressions of our sense impulses, what would we see at this first stage? Let us look into this question. The first thing we can see will surprise us. A number of forces, all aimed at permeating with impulses our entire life, from our birth, rather from conception, to our death. When trying to solve the riddle of this carpet of sense impressions, we do not see our life in its single events, but we see its entire organization or nature. At first, we would not find anything so strange. In this first stage, we find ourselves not as we are now in this moment, but as we are throughout our entire life on earth. This life, which does not extend as far as our physical body, and therefore cannot be perceived with the physical senses, permeates our etheric body, our body of formative forces, so that our body of formative forces is essentially the expression of this life. If the carpet of sense impressions were to tear, as it were, and we tear it when we ascend to spiritual vision, we would find our own self as it is organized for this current incarnation on earth. But as I stated, the senses cannot perceive this. How can we perceive this? We already possess what is necessary, but at a stage of development that does not yet make real perception possible. What we would thus perceive cannot reach the EYEI or the ear. It cannot enter any sense organ. Instead, please understand this clearly, it is breathed in, drawn in with the breath. The etheric foundation of our lung, not the physical lung, for the lung as such is not a real organ of perception, is really an organ of perception. However, between birth and death, we cannot use it as an organ of perception for what we breathe in. The air we breathe in, meaning every breath of air, and how it enters the whole rhythm of our life, really contains our deeper reality between birth and death. But here on the physical plane, the foundation of our entire lung system is in an unfinished condition, and has not yet achieved the capacity of perception. If we were to investigate what constitutes its etheric foundation, and grasp it correctly, we would find that the lung is in reality exactly the same thing as our brain and sense organs are physically for the physical world. In the foundation of our lung system, we have a brain in an earlier stage of evolution. We might say in an infant-like stage of evolution. Also in this connection, we bear a second human being within us to an extent. I say specifically to an extent.
Enter the double.
It will not be wrong if you imagine that you also possess an etheric head. It is just that this etheric head cannot yet be used as an organ of perception in our everyday life. Yet it has the possibility of perceptive capacity for what lies behind and creates the body.
Did you get that? So the second head, an etheric head, acts as an organ of perception to what lies behind and creates the body. So like an etheric probe from angelic intelligences inside your body.
However, what lies behind the etheric body as creative force is the element that we enter when we pass through the portal of death. Then we lay aside the etheric body, but we enter into what created and produced this body of formative forces. Perhaps it may be difficult to imagine this, but it will be good if you try to think this out to the end.
Go on, try it, I dare you.
This rhythmical life lies behind the carpet woven by our senses as what determines our etheric life. If we had clairvoyant consciousness, we would see this cosmic rhythm that is, as it were, a rhythmical, surging cosmic ocean, now of an astral nature. In this rhythmically surging astral ocean, we find the so-called dead and the beings of the higher hierarchies. And we find the true reality of what belongs to us but is beneath the threshold of waking consciousness, from which arise only the feelings we dream through and the will impulses we sleep through. We truly bear within us the head of a second human being, as well as a body. And this body is at first the body of an animal.
So the angle eye is the double, is the animal. Enter the centaur.
This second human being possesses a properly formed head, but attached to it is the body of an animal, a real centaur. The centaur is an etheric truth. It is important to bear in mind that active in this being is a relatively great wisdom, connected with the entire cosmic rhythm. The centaur's head sees the cosmic rhythm that permeates us during our existence between death and a new birth. It is the cosmic rhythm that has been shown in a threefold way, even numerically, which is the foundation of many secrets of the cosmos. This etheric head is much wiser than our physical head. All human beings bear within them another, far wiser human being, the centaur. Yet at the same time, in spite of its wisdom, this centaur has all the wild instincts of the animals. Now you will understand the wise guidance of the cosmos. Human beings could not be given a consciousness that is, on the one hand, strong and able to see through the cosmic rhythm, and on the other hand, uncontrolled and full of wild instincts. But the centaur's animal nature, please connect this with what I have told you in other lectures dealing with this subject from another point of view, is tamed and conquered in the next incarnation, during its passage through the world of cosmic rhythms between death and a new birth. What lies hidden at the foundation of our lung system in the present incarnation appears as our physical head in the next incarnation, although dulled down to an understanding limited to the senses. The centaur of this incarnation is the human being endowed with sense perception in the next incarnation.
Hidden at the foundation of the world. So he's saying that the etheric angel head, that's the head of the centaur within us at a subtle level in one life is reformed, purified, reconfigured in the afterlife, and then forms the blueprint for the physical head in the next incarnation. Oh, and it's in the lungs. It's the etheric organ of perception of the angel head of the centaur is in this energetic lung system. If he's talking about some sort of literal energetic lung system that's similar to the lungs, or simply because the way that it perceives is not through the ordinary, the 5 or the 12 senses, but through breathing in the physical world. If you listen carefully, you'll hear the sound of one man clutching at straws.
And now you will be able to grasp something else. You will understand why I said that during our existence between death and a new birth, the animal realm is our lowest realm, and that we must conquer its forces. We must transform the centaur, the animal in us, into a human nature for the next incarnation. This work requires a real knowledge, embracing the impulses of the whole animal realm. In the age of Chiron, human beings possessed this knowledge atavistically, in a weaker form. Although the knowledge of which Chiron spoke is weaker in this incarnation, it is of the same kind. Now, you see why human beings need this lower realm between death and a new birth. We must master it. We need it because we must transform the centaur into a human being. Human beings pass through the portal of death. Last time I mentioned how different the entire way of experiencing things becomes after death, by showing you that what we communicate to the dead comes as if out of the dead themselves, and what the deceased tell us comes as if out of the depths of our own being. In communication with the dead, the reciprocal relationships are reversed. Here on earth you can hear yourself speaking to the other human beings. You hear what you tell them, and you hear what they tell you. When you communicate with the dead, their words rise out of your own soul, and what you tell them reaches you like an echo coming from the dead. You cannot hear what you tell them as something coming from yourself. You hear this as something coming from them.
Have you had this experience? Because I have, and it's the first time I've heard it articulated. I've described it on a number of occasions. I've described it also in terms of communicating with nature. I don't associate specifically with the dead. I associate it more with angels than ancestors. But then I suppose that's my bent or my predilection or what have you. My displacement activity is to bypass the ancestors and go straight to the angle eye. But anyway, the most common experience I've had is when there's an upswelling of feeling, sensation, impulse in me to give thanks. And I say the word thank you, and as I say the word thank you, I hear or feel it within myself as something that is being said to me, that by thanking the intelligences that have guided and supported me, they are also thanking me in that same moment. There is a mirroring which makes a dialogue into, well, not a monologue, but a single expression of acknowledgement of love and appreciation.
I wanted to give this as an example of the great difference between the physical world, where we live between birth and death, and the world we live in between death and a new birth. We look into this world when we contemplate it from a certain standpoint. When we look through the carpet woven by our senses, we look into the rhythm of the world. However, this rhythm has two aspects. We must ask, who are the real beings that produce the events of a later period following an earlier one? The preceding historical events are merely the mirrored reflections they cannot be the cause of what took place subsequently. This again is one side of the question. The other side will be clear to you if you realize that the waking reality embraced by our thoughts and sense perceptions only contains illusion or Maya. This Maya cannot be the real cause of anything. However, pure thoughts can determine our actions. This fact can be experienced if we are not led to deeds by passions, desires, and instincts, but by clear thoughts.
We're back to the hand to the forehead to wave away the fly.
Pure ideas can be the impulses of human actions. Yet ideas in and of themselves cannot accomplish anything.
Please note, ideas that do not lead to action are irrelevant. Something Pauline Kael wrote, I see, that struck me a long time ago, which is some artist she knew said he had so many ideas he didn't know which ones to follow through, and she said or thought he had a strange idea of what an idea was. Dave once referred to me as a self-initiating project realizer. Idea is impulse, is action, is result. That's pure thought.
I can carry out an action under the influence of a pure idea, but the idea itself cannot do anything. We are free human beings precisely because we carry out actions under the influence of Maya. Because this Maya, the world immediately around us, cannot bring about or cause anything. Our freedom is based on the fact that the world we perceive is Maya. We unite our being with Maya and thus become free beings. If the world we perceive were a reality, this reality would compel us, and we would not be free. We must ourselves give the impetus to action if we are not induced to action by something influencing us. Freedom can be proved quite clearly if the proofs are sought on the basis that the world we perceive is a mirrored reflection and not a reality.
This is one of the most outstanding ideas I felt in this whole audio. If we accept the hypothesis that physical reality, that our senses and our minds are telling us is there, is illusory, the Maya hypothesis, even while we experience ourselves as reacting to it, what does that say about us? Either we ourselves are completely illusory, or simply that the identity self that thinks it's reacting to an illusion is itself illusory. Therefore, what is motivating or what is inspiring us to act, if it is real, is coming from the inner planes and not from the outer. It can't be stimulated by an illusion. It can only be moved by what is real. That recognizing the illusory nature of what we think of as reality is freedom, the beginning of freedom, is something I feel I can somewhat testify to from direct experience. It also speaks to Dev Oshana's formula of social enlightenment preceding true enlightenment.
These are the preparatory ideas that I wished to speak to you about, concerning what lies at the foundation of human nature, the part of human nature that can perceive reality, that has not attained the required maturity in one incarnation, but that must be weakened in order to become human in the next incarnation. The centaur, found beneath the threshold of consciousness, would be able to perceive truth and reality, but it cannot yet perceive. What we perceive today is not yet a reality. But human beings can let themselves be determined by that part of their being that is no longer, or is not yet, a centaur. Then their actions will be those of free beings. The secret of our freedom is intimately connected with the taming of our centaur nature. This centaur nature is contained in us so that it is chained and fettered, so that we may not perceive the reality of the centaur, but only the Maya. If we let ourselves be impelled by Maya, we are free. This is looked upon from one side. From the other side, we learn to know the world between death and the new birth. What otherwise surrounds us as the universe shrivels.
There we have it, ending with a shrivel and not a bang. That last point is one to meditate on, that the centaur within us, the angelic intelligence head that has an animal body, needs to be tamed in order to be set free. And in the meantime, it is fettered and chained, because if it was set free in its wildness, then it would be destructive, deeply destructive. So wild and free is not what we're going to be. It must be tame and free, or wild and chained, as far as our animal nature goes anyway. The beast, like the zombie, has to be rehabilitated before it can be allowed to join the family, the collective family. Freedom is not free. So I'm going to end there on a question mark. I have many more audios. There are hundreds of these things at the website, RudolfSteinerAudios.com. I don't know if I'll continue, but at the moment I'm in the swing of things, and so I guess I'll see how it goes and what sort of response I get. There will be those who enjoy and appreciate this new departure, and there'll be those who I think won't. So we'll just see. I will follow the impulses of the ancestors and the Angeli in order to best determine the right course ahead. The one last thing before we end this liminalist. Don't let any of these high concepts and big ideas go to your head. Turn into systems of belief or crucial fictions. Been there, done that. They will not help you in any way as ideas to play with. And they may in fact hinder you. So, rather than taking them to the head, take them to the feet, all the way down and into the earth. Just let them flow out of you. Forget everything that either I or Dale or Rudolf has said on this podcast, as concepts, as ideas, and as language. It may be worse than useless, unless that is it leads to a window onto a sensational and even a sensory reality, in which case then allow the momentum of the ideas that may turn into impulses and into actions to draw you closer to the window, so you can see more what's on the other side, and maybe even turn it into a door. I don't want this to be Icarus Chronicles of a False Awakening Part 2. Let this be a restoration, recycling, and a redemption of old dog-eared concepts into a real set of wings.